Welcome to another T-Rex Talk podcast, and believe it or not, there's a missing episode. This is episode number 100 and something, just like 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago, talked about the Ukrainian invasion and the war that is going on, and this week we're also talking about that. And I was going to record a podcast in between these two, and something happened instead. Hey, Clara, did you have a little sister get born?
Yeah.
How old is she?
Zero.
She is 0 years old. Not very many days old. Baby number four arrived a little bit ahead of schedule, which kind of threw off the podcast schedule. But in the meantime, I continue doing a little bit of research, talking to folks, and we're recording another episode. And this isn't going to focus primarily upon the war that is happening in Ukraine right now, but kind of the media and social media backlash that is going on. I did see that this is becoming kind of ridiculous at this point. I saw a tweet that sort of captures some of the ridiculousness. It said, it's crazy that there is a live stream of a burning nuclear power plant in a battlefield between two major European countries. But before you can watch it, you have to watch a Domino's ad. That's a pretty good observation. I feel like that encapsulates kind of the insanity of what is going on. But essentially, over the last couple of weeks, the Russian military got off to a very slow, chaotic, expensive, bad start. But then again, if you study military history in Russia, you learn that the Russian military actions pretty much always start off slow, chaotic, expensive, and bad. So the situation over there, essentially things appear to have stalled. They appear to be stagnant. But that doesn't mean that anything is over yet. And the media frenzy is also not over. Now, a lot of people have called me on some stuff that I said in the last episode and basically said, how dare you assume that Ukraine might possibly be justified in defending their homeland because the mainstream media has chosen Ukraine's side. The mainstream media has been wrong about so many things for so long, so consistently, that whatever it is that they say is happening, the opposite must certainly be true. And I would say that there's a lot to be said for that particular argument, except for the fact that there is so much inconsistency here, and this is just a wild emotional thing. Again, I'm not denying the fact that there are deep and terrifying globalist conspiracies that exist, and yet what is happening in this particular instance is so wild and inconsistent and controlled, it doesn't actually require this sort of manipulative, totally under the control of the shadowy globalist elites. This is a lot of totally uninformed emotional virtue signaling going on by the kind of people who you would expect to go the other way, except for one simple fact. They spent the last 5 years blaming Russia for Hillary's tragic presidential campaign loss against Donald Trump. And so they've already picked sides long before any of this stuff broke out, long before they even Googled Ukraine to see what exactly it was. And the mainstream media is giving it a huge amount of coverage. I don't believe because they've been told to by George Soros and his ilk. I think it's because they are desperate to cover something besides COVID at this point. COVID is over. COVID is so over that the Babylon Bee ran an article saying that you have to, if you're going into a New York City restaurant, you have to provide proof of Ukraine support before they will let you in the door. You don't have to provide proof of vaccines anymore. The mainstream media would definitely devote 24-hour, 7-day-a-week coverage to a war between Sweden and Togo, even before they looked up Togo on a map. And a lot of the powers that be, I think, are in exactly the same boat. COVID is over, and people are done with all of this nonsense, and information is coming out that is not pleasant, and so hardcore authoritarians like Justin Trudeau and so forth and so on need to get rid of some of the controls that they put in place, but they need to do it in a way where they don't lose face. They need distractions, and so this emotional outpouring of global support for Ukraine, that's something that everybody can get behind. It doesn't require a huge amount of manipulation. It really is just the right thing at the right time. And because it's primarily emotionally driven, it doesn't have to be consistent. And a friend of mine actually made a comment on this that I think is really, really telling. If you remember what the world was like right after 9/11, right after the September 11th attacks, every single person on the face of the earth, with a few exceptions, was completely 100% in commiseration and support of the United States, even countries that had no reason to support the United States at all and never had in the past. And that highly emotional commiseration and empathy for the United States lasted for about 3 weeks. And as my friend pointed out, at the end of 3 weeks, everybody reverted back to their factory settings. And I think we're going to see something like that happen here. It may just take a little longer than 3 weeks. Everything happens extremely fast these days in the news cycle, and everything requires that everybody be all in all the time. If you remember, a few months ago, we were talking about Kyle Rittenhouse because everybody was talking about Kyle Rittenhouse. Kyle Rittenhouse was front page news everywhere, front and center, and he was either the harbinger of the end of civilization or he was the salvation of civilization. He was everything for about a month, and then he was gone, completely gone, and you haven't probably heard about him since. And the response to this war is a much bigger thing. This war right here, this is the war of the ages, and it probably will be for another few weeks. Now, I do think it's going to be a much larger deal than a lot of people even think that it is, but at the same time, it is not the be-all, end-all of everything that some people say that it is. The news cycle is going to end at some point, and the war will even end. But one of the things that I think is really interesting is there have been some knee-jerk reactions from social media folks, from big corporations, and from governments. Those knee-jerk reactions are not going to end overnight, and the effects of those policies are going to last for a very, very long time. For example, we've seen a whole bunch of companies making these broad, sweeping gestures. Again, these are virtue signaling moves. These are highly emotional moves, but they have huge implications. So a lot of big tech companies have essentially been deplatforming the entire country of Russia for the last few weeks. So TikTok has cut off Russia. Netflix has cut off Russia. Facebook has cut off Russia, although Russia said, you can't fire us. We quit. They cut off Facebook. Twitter cut off Russia. YouTube has partially blocked Russia, but also, if you are in the United States, blocked a whole bunch of Russian information and a whole bunch of documentaries about Russia and Ukraine. Microsoft has blocked a bunch of services in Russia, including Xbox Live. If you live in Russia, you can't play Minecraft anymore, et cetera, et cetera. And that's actually not so bad if you're Russia. I would actually welcome the opportunity to separate a whole bunch of American people from the services of Netflix. But there's a bunch of financial companies and a bunch of financial services that are also no longer serving, not just Russia, the country, but individual Russian citizens, PayPal, Etsy, all kinds of card processing services, and even card issuers are demanding that Russian citizens not be allowed to use these things that they are relying on at this time. And I've got some feelings about this while we're being emotional. T-Rex Arms has also been permabanned from PayPal. This deplatforming that happens is something that should not be a stranger to anyone who's listening to this podcast. This should not be something that is a strange idea to anybody that's been paying attention to conservative politics for a while. But deplatform an entire country is just really almost mind-boggling to me. I follow on Instagram a whole bunch of random tactical suppliers, including some people in Russia who make tactical equipment for very specific things on a really small, small level, and even some guys who make things specifically for airsoft over there. And almost immediately after all of this stuff happened, they were saying, if you have ordered anything from us, please contact me through Instagram. I can no longer see my Etsy store. If you have purchased anything, I can no longer have access to your money inside of the PayPal account. I can't get to it. Let me know if PayPal has refunded your money so you can pay me a different way and I can figure out what your address is and send it to you because all my e-commerce capability is now gone. Hopefully we can kind of reconstruct whatever stuff we had in the pipeline through Instagram. Hopefully that keeps working. So these are random, regular Russian citizens who no longer have the opportunity to easily do independent business stuff. And the list of services goes on and on and on. Adobe cut off all the Russian citizens from the ability to use the Creative Suite, so no more Photoshop, no more Premiere. And of course, the easy joke is that we could say, again, how lucky those Russians are. They no longer have to deal with Premiere Pro crashing. But the fact of the matter is, this is problematic, even for Adobe's stated goals, One of the folks that all of these emotional virtue signaling people are saying is that Putin is not a democratically elected leader. He doesn't represent the people. He's a dictator. He's bad, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But none of these sanctions, none of this deplatforming actually affects Putin at all. It doesn't hurt him. It only hurts the people who didn't elect him. None of this stuff affects the oligarchs that own massive billion-dollar businesses that they didn't build. They are not hiring people inside of Russia to make them stuff using Photoshop and Illustrator. All of their ad agencies are in New York and Paris. This doesn't affect them in the slightest. Now, potentially, some of them are affected by the fact that Starbucks shut down all of their stores, but I'm not sure what Starbucks is doing with all of their employees. Even McDonald's shut down all of their franchises inside of Russia. And interestingly, they kept all of their 62,000 employees on their furloughed with pay. So at least those 62,000 McDonald's employees for now are still being paid, even though the stores are shut. And I'm sure that Putin and everybody at the Kremlin is just really bummed that they can no longer get Big Macs. And I'm not really sure what the upshot of all of this deplatforming is going to be. Coinbase, which is the largest U.S. cryptocurrency exchange, they blocked 25,000 Russian customers from making any kind of transactions or deals. Quick side note. There's a lot of services that spring up making decentralized services easier to use by adding centralization. And it's very tempting to want to use those guys as a middleman because they take all the pain and difficulty, all of the cons of decentralization out of the picture, make everything simple and convenient and easy to use. But they add back in all of the disadvantages of centralization. They can shut down all of your accounts. Even though crypto is supposed to allow you to transfer money anonymously in a decentralized fashion, yeah, just keep that in mind. And not all of these sweeping sanctions are being done purely out of the emotional virtue signaling desire of the corporations. Some of it is indeed global meddling. So, for example, the EU demanded that Telegram block Russia Today's news source on the Telegram platform because it was a, quote, a means of war propaganda. And Telegram complied. You can no longer see RT material on Telegram. It's also been removed from a whole bunch of other places, Twitter, Facebook, Roku, DirecTV, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I'm actually kind of okay with this because Russia Today is a state-run media platform. But I would like to see a little bit of consistency here. If we're going to kick RT off of some of these big social media platforms, I would also like to cut off PBS, NPR, BBC, etc. And I'd like to see some consistency with mapping stuff too. If Apple is going to change the Crimean Peninsula back to Ukraine in Apple Maps, could they please do that with Hong Kong? Could we please ask them to not switch Taiwan over to China anytime soon, regardless of what happens in the upcoming thing that's going to happen? And it's not just the EU. Ukraine has asked that ICANN block Russia from top-level domains such as .ru. So basically, Russia is being cut off. And again, this is the entire nation of Russia. This is all of the people inside of Russia, not just Russia, the state entity, not just Russia, the government, but Russia, the entire country and group of citizens, regardless of what they believe, regardless of what they are doing, are being sort of systematically cut off and divided from financial services, from informational services, even from Minecraft. And I think this is actually super counterproductive. It does the exact opposite of what most of these social media companies and fast food chains say that it's going to do. This actually, I believe, helps Putin because I don't think anything will make people rally to him more than cutting them off from the West. All of this anti-West conversation or all of this anti-West propaganda that exists over there is really being reinforced by the extreme overreaction that is being taken here. And I almost wonder at this point, did Putin force these sanctions and embargoes by what he was doing? Did he actually kind of see this coming and say, this is when I burn my ships like Cortez did? This is when I force people back into a sort of an isolated national socialistic state, ironically enough. The government will bail out the lower classes that have been abandoned by Western financial institutions in a time of trouble. We will polarize them against the evil West, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not actually sure, but I think that that is going to be one of the potential outcomes of this ridiculously over-the-top and misguided set of virtue signals. And the oil embargo that Biden just announced, I don't think that it's actually going to affect Russia quite that much. United States no longer buying any oil from Russia. But you know what? The demand is there. Oil will be sold from Russia to somebody else. It will almost certainly be purchased by China. This is a way for China to get cheap oil, and this is a way for Russia to sell oil to China at maybe not the prices that America is paying Venezuela for oil, say, but certainly they will be able to sell oil from China at the prices that they were selling oil to us last week or last month. And so now the West doesn't really have access to the resources that Russia had, and Russia still has access to all of the money that they would have been making from the West now that they are selling this stuff directly to China. And perhaps Russian citizens will switch over to the various Chinese versions of internet services and financial services, and they'll no longer be using the Western ones. This raises a lot of questions. Does Russia become a vassal state of China, or is this more like an equal partnership thing? Because China is isolating itself more and more from the United States, more and more from the West, and now Russia is, whether it wants to or not, doing exactly the same thing. And here in the West, now that we've kind of put all these embargoes in place, our prices are going up. Coal, oil, gas, all of these things are up. Now, I should point out that these things have been going up for a very long time. We haven't actually seen increased prices due to the war quite yet. We've seen increased prices due to speculation, due to uncertainty of war. But for the last 12 months, a lot of energy prices have gone up, and a bunch of other prices are going to go up, because not only does Russia export a lot of oil, not only does it export a lot of natural gas, not only does it export electricity, but it is the primary exporter of nickel, which is required for all sorts of things, like making stainless steel, various other alloys, making electronics, and also batteries. A week or two ago, nickel's value tripled, and the London Metals Exchange actually halted trades because it was so volatile, but China kept buying nickel. We're only just now seeing the effects of Russia on the prices of all of these things that the White House has been blaming Russia for increased prices on for a little while. This is a 12-month trend with just a little teeny spike of the last couple weeks now. We've barely begun to see the effects of the war and these embargoes on the prices of our consumer goods, but we will. Gas prices is pretty obvious. Late-night talk show hosts are talking about how paying a few extra dollars for gas is worth a clear conscience. I actually would take issue with that because now that we're not giving this money to Russia, we will be giving it to Venezuela and to Saudi Arabia and a bunch of other people that I don't have a clear conscience supporting. Pete Buttigieg said, let them drive Teslas when people asked about the high gas prices. So that makes him the Marie Antoinette of the 21st century. Also, I would like to point out, Democrats have been complaining for years and years and years that Elon Musk makes too much money, and they are now saying everybody should go out and buy Teslas. This is one of the most out-of-touch things that I can imagine. And Teslas are going to get a lot more expensive because the lithium batteries inside of Teslas are getting scarcer. Lithium prices have gone up 600% in the last year. That's not because of the war in Russia. That is in the last 12 months. And coal is up more than gas is. So electricity is going to cost more. So charging your electric car, even if you did manage to get one, is going to be more expensive. And again, if we're not going to be able to get steel and nickel from Russia, we're going to have trouble with batteries and other electronics that are required for these electric vehicles. And the thing is, even if the war stops tomorrow and everything goes back to normal and all of the powers that be pretend like nothing happened, the way that they're going to pretend like nothing happened with COVID vaccine stuff, there are still huge costs coming that we have yet to see. There's all kind of ripple effects from things. Like, for example, Russia is a huge wheat exporter. Ukraine is also huge. They're the fifth largest wheat producer. And this war is happening, I don't know my dates precisely, but it's right around planting season for them. And while the media tends to focus on the battles that are happening inside of the big cities, what is happening to the small towns matters a lot. What happens in these farming villages matters a lot for future food prices. And even in Western Ukraine, where there hasn't been a whole lot of fighting yet, there are farmers who are leaving their towns and heading east so that they can fight. This has kind of an unknown impact. And then even if there's no impact on farming whatsoever, and the Odessa port gets destroyed, it'll be very expensive to export wheat from Ukraine, even if they do have it. And also, I would say that the farm tractors in Ukraine, far too busy salvaging abandoned Russian tanks to actually do any cultivating. As a joke, sort of. Oh, I should probably take another quick rabbit trail on the issue of propaganda. People out there are saying that when you see these Russian farmers salvaging abandoned Russian tanks, it's only propaganda, and all this Ukrainian propaganda has been carefully crafted and aimed at American Disney Plus level soy boy Marvel fans. I actually disagree. I think that the propaganda that we see coming out of Ukraine is in exactly the same style as classic Russian and Slavic propaganda from the Great Patriotic War. Like almost identical characters, indomitable and mysterious ghost-like pilots, invincible snipers, indomitable citizens defying clueless soldiers with some easily adoptable symbols, indomitable martyrs who spat in the face of the inhuman invaders, etc., etc., etc. These are the very same stereotypical, archetypical figures from Russian history. I honestly think that we are seeing Ukrainian propaganda, and it strikes a chord with Americans who love underdogs. We're not seeing George Soros carefully create a narrative that Instagrammers are falling for in the West. But like I said, that's a rabbit trail. Getting back on topic, I would just point out that food, energy, and raw materials have all been up in price, and they've been going up in price very consistently over the last year before any of this kicked off, and things are just going to get worse. So regardless of what happens with Russia, with Ukraine, regardless of what happens in Europe, be aware that American inflation and American prices on a whole bunch of things are going to be very, very different, and they're not going to change in a particularly good way for some time. And then there's Taiwan. But we'll talk about Taiwan later. Now, for the record, because I think some people were a little bit confused by some of the stuff that I talked about in the podcast, I am not actually advocating that America enter this war. I don't want the U.S. to enter this war. I do want Ukrainians to successfully repel this invasion, but I don't want Russia to revert to a Soviet-style culture. Now, I do want an end to globalism. There's a bunch of people who there have said that you must either support Russia or you must support European globalism. And this is actually a podcast episode on all its own, because this is exactly what was being said in the 1930s. It was said you must embrace either national socialism of Germany or you must embrace international socialism of Soviet utopia. These are the only two options that celebrities and intelligentsia offered to the people. There was apparently no middle ground. You had to pick one or you had to pick the other. And right now on social media, we're hearing the exact same thing. You must either choose globalism if you want Ukraine to win, you're pro-globalist, and if you want something else, then you have to want Russia to win. I'm actually disappointed that we have fallen for such an obvious two-sided lesser of two evils kind of conversation that is emotional and is uninformed, because I would like Russia to be repelled. I would like the invasion to end and the Ukrainians to single-handedly or with a little bit of help, but on their own, defend themselves, because I do want an end of globalization and globalism. So I'm actually very disappointed that Ukraine now wants to join the EU. I want Ukraine to not join the EU, and I want Russia to not invade Ukraine. I'm told that I cannot want both of these things. I have to pick one or the other. I disagree. I want both of these countries to not be part of the EU and to not be at war with one another. I also want all the countries that are currently in the EU to not be in the EU. I want all of these countries to be defending themselves and be capable of defending themselves against Russia or other threats in a much more independent and ad hoc way. So one of the things that I have actually been thinking about in the past couple of weeks is I think the treaties should have a much more limited lifespan than they tend to. If geopolitical treaties between countries or groups of countries or coalitions last longer than the countries or the governments inside of those countries, that's actually kind of bad. I think it's clear that that can cause significant issues. I also think that it's time for the EU to go. I think it's probably time for NATO to go, and people can make new treaties and new alliances based on the current culture and the politics as it changes. And for all the people out there who want Russia to win so that globalism can end, I don't think that actually will accomplish this at all. I think the EU and NATO will harden against the Russian bear if Ukraine falls, and everyone will then globalize even more so that they can more effectively oppose this Russia slash China whatever. Now, Russia losing probably creates some sort of weird Russia-China coalition that everybody on the globalist front will use as motivation to try to connect everybody together into a gigantic new world order. But going back to what I said at the beginning of the episode, I think that this Russia-Ukraine conflict is going to last a lot longer than a lot of people think that it will. And I think that the pro-Ukraine response that we are currently seeing in the West is going to last a lot shorter than people think that it will. And that just makes it really hard to predict what some of the outcomes could possibly be. And while I am generally optimistic, I mean, I am almost always generally optimistic, I actually see a lot of very, very difficult times coming, both in Europe and in Eastern Europe and in Russia and in the West. I think that these are really difficult things that are happening, and the effects of them are going to be very significant. I'm not nearly as pessimistic, obviously, as the conspiracy theory folks who believe that everything has been planned down to the last bullet, down to the last piece of rubble, down to the last photoshopped Ukrainian Instagram post that was put together by I'm not sure who exactly, but hopefully they don't have Adobe Creative Suite license anymore. But I do see some opportunities for upsides here. And one of them is that I feel like we're getting a preview of the kind of conflict that feels inevitable in the West. I think that that is something that is highly educational and will help people to prepare for that in a whole bunch of different ways. Even people, and I can't believe that I'm saying this, like Elon Musk. I'm actually fascinated by the fact that Starlink, his satellite internet service, is something that he's been developing for a long time, but its later stages of development are going to be, interestingly enough, more affected by deploying them in a wartime and civilian militia environment than anybody planned. There's going to be a huge amount of Starlink beta testing that is going on with jamming and trying to develop low probability of intercept into the design structure. 6 months ago, I am confident nobody at SpaceX was putting that on their whiteboards. Also, I do have to give a little bit of a shout out to Elon Musk. His response to this whole thing has been far more level-headed than I ever expected. He has asked for the world to consider restarting its nuclear power plants and to build up more power generation with oil and with coal, because it is necessary, even though this is kind of something that will affect his company in a negative way. And when Ukraine asked for Starlink terminals, he supplied them. He explained how they could use them to better be protected as they're using them. But then when people asked him to block all Russian internet and to block RT on this service, he said no. He's going to allow information to be free. He's going to support the people that he believes need some support with some equipment, but he's not going to stifle the conversation. And I think that shows a fair level of maturity on his part. In fact, the media also demanded that he shut down and remotely disable all of the Teslas that are currently driving in Russia, which actually would potentially affect mostly oligarchs and high party officials and Kremlin people and possibly even some of Putin's own staff. But I think that he did the right thing there and said not to meddle in that. That being said, cars that can be remotely disabled, just write down not to buy those in the future. Just FYI, you'll thank me later. If you'd like to get into crypto and the easy way is a big centralized server and the hard way is handling your old ledger, do it the hard way. Just trust me on this. And the good news is I think that a lot of people are learning this lesson even if they aren't really conscious of it. Supply chain issues falling apart because of the early COVID stuff happening in China taught people to be less globalistic in the way that they did manufacturing. The turmoils and difficulties of the war that are about to descend upon the supply chains of Europe are going to teach people to be a little bit more careful, to be a little bit more cautious, to value anti-fragility a lot more, even if the whole thing is some kind of globalistic plot to tie everyone closer together and make them more dependent. So I actually see a lot of benefits here. Yes, when authoritarians take control of things, they end up controlling things. And yet the pushback can often be really, really helpful. There's a whole bunch of things that are incredibly positive to come out of the response to the response to COVID-19. And one of them is homeschooling. The fact that homeschoolers in America doubled in the year 2020 is probably one of the most important facts that will change the future more than any other. And I think that it is an entirely accidental backfiring of a plan, which is kind of where I want to end this thing. I'm not claiming that global conspiracies don't ever exist, because they always do. My point is that global conspiracies are never globally effective. And everything that is happening provides an opportunity for people to be better prepared for the future. So keep thinking about the stuff that we talked about in the previous episode. Keep building capabilities, whether they are defense capabilities, manufacturing capabilities, or otherwise. And now, if you'll excuse me, I have a very small child to go spend some time with.